From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio.
Science and technology that's accessible and entertaining.
If we can understand it, you can understand it.
I'm Lynn Ware Peake.
And I'm John Wells. Our first guest this morning is Susan Tyler Hitchcock, who has just written Into the Forest, The Secret Language of Trees. Writing for National Geographic, Hitchcock combines legendary photography with cutting-edge science to show exactly how trees influence the life of planet Earth, from our personal lives to the weather cycle. We look forward to our conversation with Susan.
Our second guest this morning is Tim Menard, who asks this question: why is it that our smartphones have so many capabilities, but it seems like the technology driving our traffic lights is stuck in the 1970s? Ever been stuck at a traffic light at midnight for, 2 minutes? Tim is the CEO and founder of Light. It's a company that provides intelligent traffic solutions.
These two guests when we return. You're listening to Cool Science Radio. And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. Lynn and I pre-recorded this conversation 2 weeks ago. Here it is for you now. Enjoy. Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm John Wells. I'm here with Lynn Ware Peake. Our next guest is Susan Tyler Hitchcock, a writer specializing in history, nature, and science, who has just written Into the Forest, The Secret Language of Trees. Writing for National Geographic, Hitchcock combines legendary photography with cutting-edge science to show exactly how trees influence the life of planet Earth, from our personal lives to the weather cycle. Susan Tyler Hitchcock, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you. Cool Science sounds great.
Yeah, well, we are very pleased to have you with us this morning. In the tradition of Nat Geo, the pictures are extraordinary. The writing that you have done is, it's really a love letter to forests, and it's really a cool book. So maybe we can start with this. Tell us how you organized this book.
Sure. I had the idea from the very beginning that I would use the four elements, the four ancient elements of earth, water, air, and fire to organize the book. So that's four of the chapters, but they are bookended by a chapter on tree and a chapter on forest. So I think of it as starting out by talking about what is a tree, the biology of a tree, then talk about the soil that it sits in, the water that moves up through it, the fire that affects it sometimes, and the air that it breathes and that it breathes into helping us and the planet survive. And then I pull it all together with a chapter on the forest itself.
Yes. Okay. And what do you mean when you say the secret language of trees?
I mean two different things, really. Well, many different things, but I think of it as going in two different directions. On the one hand, trees do communicate with one another, and that is definitely part of the cool science going on about trees nowadays. There are ways in which trees communicate both in the air and underground, particularly the work of Suzanne Simard, a forest ecologist just in British Columbia who contributed the foreword to my book. She's discovering ways in which trees provide either alarm signals or nourishment to one another through the network of fungus under the trees. And she really is talking about trees caring for one another. She describes mother trees, which are the elder trees in old forests, that even as they are dying, are nourishing the trees around them of their own species and also of other species. So it's that's one of the kinds of ways that one of the ways that there is language between trees. But the trees also speak a secret language to us that we have been hearing, we've been listening, we've been living with all our lives. And what I hope is that perhaps this book can remind people to pay a little bit more attention to that. Trees are at the center of probably every mythology in the world. A tree stands at the center of mythologies. For example, the Maori people in New Zealand believe that Tane, the god of the forest, who was the son of the sky god and the earth god, that he laid down on his back and pushed with his feet to separate his parents, thus making room for humans to dwell. There are many myths like that, and that's one of the pleasures that I had as I was writing this book, is finding the myths about trees. Many, many traditions talk about roots going into the underworld and branches going up to the heavens, and we are the humans in between, the trunk in between, that have our we can reach in both directions. So the stories of trees go on and on. And I think it's partly because trees were here long before we humans even walked the planet. The fossils that have been found of proto-trees have been dated to 385 million years ago. That's 100 million years before there were even dinosaurs. So trees have been here long before us in evolutionary times. But also, if you think about it in your own lifetime, there are trees that were standing there when you were born and that will still be standing there when you die. So there's this sort of elder wisdom that we find in trees that I'm, you know, more and more aware of and respecting, and hoping to bring that respect to my readers as well.
It's obvious to me that just hearing you speak and then seeing your book, how passionate you are about this topic. And, you know, professionally, you have a PhD in English literature from UVA, University of Virginia, and, you know, trees are not necessarily in your professional background. So can you tell us about your communion with trees and how that came about to even be able to arrive at this place of creating this work of art that you've created?
So I grew up in Michigan, and I grew up in a house that was on the edge of the forest. And I would come home from school, from elementary school, and just my playtime was a walk in the forest behind our house. And it's funny, you mentioned my work at the university. I was writing a PhD dissertation on the poetry of Percy Bysshe Shelley, and I would write in the morning, and then, you know, about mid-afternoon, that would be about all I could do. And I would take a walk, actually with my goats. I would take a walk into the forest, and I had such a wonderful time watching the goats browsing around and figuring out what they wanted to eat. And at the same time, in that period of time, began to learn about gathering wild things, gathering wild edible plants. And indeed, my first book, which I published in 1980, is called Gather Ye Wild Things, A Forager's Year. It's about gathering wild things, and it all comes from spending time in the forest in those years in the late 70s, way, way back when. So nowadays, I still live in Central Virginia, and I live in a house that my husband and I built on the edge of a forest. So I still walk. I don't have goats, but I have a dog, and we take walks in the forest every day. So forests have been a part of my life all my life, and it felt very natural to explore forests intellectually, since I'd been doing it on foot all my life.
Well, it's my hope that John and I, at some point before we end our lives, can say, I was out taking my goats for a walk in the forest. I mean, that's just cool.
I'd love that. That'd be fantastic.
I know. Just a couple days ago in southern Utah, I was in this incredible juniper forest. And you may know that here in the mountains around Park City, we have beautiful aspen forests. And I think, You know, I often, when I have visitors come here and we go for a walk among the aspen trees, we say, oh, you know, this is the world's largest organism, that all these aspen trees are connected. It's one big family. And that really leaves this indelible sort of imprint on people, that somehow it humanizes trees. And I think this, to a really large extent, is what you're doing in your book. You're kind of, you know, with the secret language of trees, you're painting this very humanistic picture of trees, and it's a great way for us to grow a love and respect. Can you talk about this humanness of trees, and was that your intention?
Sure. I read along the way of a couple of botanists, James Wandersee and Elizabeth Schussler, who in 1999 proposed that we all suffer from what they call plant blindness. We give our children stuffed animals, not stuffed plants. We take our children to zoos instead of botanical gardens. And we really grow up paying attention to the animal world, not so much the plant world. And I realized, even myself growing up and spending so much time in the forest, I had sort of a tree blindness. I didn't really think about the tree itself, and in fact, the forest and the importance of the forest to me, but also more importantly to the planet, until I was researching this book. So, you know, there's a very intimate relationship between trees and human beings. If you go back to high school biology, photosynthesis, what happens with photosynthesis in a green leaf? The leaf takes in carbon dioxide and water, and it gives off oxygen, which we breathe. It also holds in carbon and uses that to create itself, its own food. So the tree, the trunk, the roots, the branches, the leaves, the flowers, the seeds, the fruit, all of that is carbon-based. And so trees are actually the original natural carbon sink. These days, with the concern about global warming and the excess carbon in the atmosphere, let's remember that trees themselves, and especially the old forests, are the original natural carbon sink of the planet. It's the reason why we're talking so much about losing our rainforests, losing our old forests. That is part of this cycle that we're trying to figure out how to back up a little bit and to improve the atmosphere of the planet. The trees are key to doing that.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we are speaking with Susan Tyler Hitchcock. She has written Into the Forest, The Secret Language of Trees. It's a Nat Geo product, as you could expect. The photos are spectacular. And the writing is, as I mentioned in the introduction, is very lovingly. It's a love letter to forests. I wanted to ask you about this, Susan. There is a trail here in Park City. It's my favorite trail. It's called the Silver Lake Trail. And it goes up this mountain, Bald Mountain, and it circuitously wraps around the mountain several times as you head towards the top. And I go through deep forest, and then 5 minutes later, I'm crossing a ski trail, and then I go back into the deep forest, and this process continues for a little over an hour. There's something about when I'm in the deep forest, the smell of the soil, the decaying leaves, I'm not really sure what it is, but there's something about being in the deep forest that makes me feel really good. And I know it has something to do about the soils, and you talk about it in your book. Can you tell me what that is?
Sure. This is a word that I learned in the process of researching this book that I'd never heard before. When you pick up a handful of forest soil and it smells so good, the compound that you are smelling is called geosmin. G-E-O-S-M-I-N, geosmin, which comes from combining the word earth and the word smell. pretty ugly word in a way for a beautiful thing. But what we're finding is that not only the soil, but also the air of the forest contains compounds that are soothing to the human body and mind. Some compounds that are even closely related to antidepressants. And so it's, you know, it is a psychological experience, but turns out it's actually a physical experience as well. There are things in the air, both from the soil and from the trees above, that are calming you and helping you feel happier. A lot of that research has been done in support of the Japanese program of forest bathing, Shinrin-yoku, which was established in the 90s in Japan in response to the increased urbanization. At this point, more than 90% of people in Japan live in the city. And a very a genius minister of the government back in the 80s decided that Japan should establish certain parks with lots of trees in them for and a practice called forest bathing or Shinrin-yoku. It's now a worldwide phenomenon. You read about it all the time, but it was originally a government-sponsored program in Japan to offset the effects of urban life.
Okay. Lynn and I have both had the opportunity to watch a movie called Fabulous Fungi, where they talk about mycelium and this ancient networking which is below our feet and which is connecting the forest together. Can you tell us a little about that, some of the science behind that?
Yeah, sure. Well, this is the science being promoted by and practiced by Suzanne Simard, who was in that film and who provided the foreword for my book. What she's discovering, she and her students are discovering, is that there are ways that trees in a healthy large forest use that network, that fungal network under them, to send messages, if you will, chemical messages, sometimes alerts, alarm messages, and sometimes nourishing, that is nutrients, to one another. One experiment I remember, they put saplings of two species, Douglas fir and ponderosa pine, near one another, side by side, but covered the tops of the seedlings. So the only way that any kind of interaction could happen is in the soil itself. They pulled the needles off of the Douglas pine and found that in response, the Douglas fir found that in response, the ponderosa pine would bulk up an enzyme that strengthened its needles. And as I say, the saplings were, the top of the trees were covered. So the only interaction that could be happening was through the soil. This is just a small, like a snapshot of what she believes is happening all through the old growth forests of our planet.
Boy, that's wonderful. If you talk about, and you know, it's hard to bring into this conversation deforestation, but depending on the statistics, and I'm sure you've got the most recent ones, you know, somewhere about a third, we've lost a third of the forests on our planet. And what does that mean to you? We know that it means, you know, loss of diversity, loss of the health of our soil, loss of all kinds of things, carbon sink, as you talked about before. But what does that really mean to you from your perspective, having written this book?
It has been said that the rainforests in particular, that all around the tropical band of our planet, that the rainforests are the lungs of the earth. And the rainforests in particular are really being decimated by the trees are being cut down to make more open land to either graze cattle. And as I understand it, a lot of that cattle is coming to the United States for beef here. And also in Indonesia, A lot of the tropical trees are being cut down for plantations, particularly palm oil plantations. So what does it mean to me? I realize that one tiny little thing that I can do is to change my consumer habits. Eat and buy less beef. Eat fewer products, processed food products that contain palm oil. I mean, it's tiny. It's a tiny effort, but if everybody makes a tiny effort, it gets bigger. I also encourage people to support financially some of the organizations, the nonprofits that are really concerned with the livelihood of the old forests, whether it's Rainforest Alliance for the rainforests or the Old Growth Forest Network for the old forests. That's a really important way of contributing to the future of the forests and the planet.
Yes. With your tagline, "The Secret Language of Trees," you mean this figuratively, but you also mean it quite literally. And so I have to ask you about the acacia tree that communicates when those predatory giraffes come to pretty much, you know, strip it of all its leaves and bark, I suppose.
Yeah, it's mostly the leaves. This is a classic example of a communication among trees within a species. The acacia is a very common tree in the savanna of Africa, and it's the leaves are a giraffe hors d'oeuvre. They love them, and they come and nibble the top of one acacia tree. What happens when the leaves begin to be eaten is that acacia tree puts off a volatile, an essential oil that moves in the air to other nearby acacia trees, and they respond by turning their leaves bitter so that when the giraffe ambles over to the next tree, the leaves are unpalatable and not eaten. So it's an amazing example of communication among trees in the air that actually has evolved. I'm sure it's evolved. And actually, I read in an article recently that now giraffes have learned to eat according to the prevailing winds. That the giraffes have actually learned what the trees are doing, and they're outsmarting the trees. So,
wow, how about that?
Nature is infinitely intelligent.
We are speaking with Susan Tyler Hitchcock. She has written Into the Forest, The Secret Language of Trees. It is the 150th anniversary of Arbor Day this year, and we hope that you go out and check this book out. Susan, we wish you continued success with your book, and we thank you so much for joining us this morning on Cool Science Radio.
It has been a great pleasure. Thank you. And I will leave with one thought. Every day should be Arbor Day.
I love it. I love it. Thank you, Susan.
Thank you.
Love our trees. Susan Tyler Hitchcock. And she makes a great point. And especially now here as we're every other day, it seems, seeing spring here in Park City. Today we'll see a little more of winter, but we are loving seeing the buds come out on the aspen trees, and it's a great time of year. My favorite time of year. How about you, John?
Yeah, the mosquitoes are beautiful this year in southern Maine. There's a lot of mosquitoes here.
Yes. Okay. Well, that leads me into just a brief discussion of where my beloved co-host has gone. I'm speaking to you. You are sitting somewhere in a beautiful little cottage in southern Maine. And as a lot of people know, it's a small town here, a small area. A lot of people know that John Wells, who's been with us at KPCW for about 10 years, decided to do a little relocating, or maybe just, you know, kind of living around the globe. And he is so dedicated to Cool Science Radio and his love of this radio station that he decided to to keep going, right?
And yeah, I mean, I love doing this show, and you and I have figured out a way technically to be able to host this thing remotely, and hopefully it'll be a good experience for the listeners.
Yeah, we hope so. So let us know. And as always, you know, we love to hear from our listeners. Coolscienceradio at kpcw.org. If you have a story idea, or if you just want to let us know how you're enjoying the show, and you know, also maybe we ask for your patience in case this remote technology, you know, betrays us here and there.
Yeah, I think we're going to do okay, but...
Yeah, it'll have nothing
hey, Lynn,
to do with
I wanted
with
to mention to you that yeah. Brian Scarry, who was involved with The Secret of Whales, that three-part Nat Geo series with James Cameron that ended up on Disney and Disney Plus, he lives here in York, Maine.
Is that right? Well, hopefully you can connect with him. A really great connection that we have here at Cool Science Radio with National Geographic, and they provide us with a lot of great guests like Brian Scarry, like Susan Tyler Hitchcock, who we just spoke with. And what a beautiful book that is. I recently took that book on a road trip with my mother, who loves trees, and, you know, was just amazed by what she saw in that book. Okay, we're going to take a quick break, and we will be back with Tim Menard of Light. It's going to be a fascinating conversation, so stay with us. Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peake, here with John Wells. Our next guest is Tim Menard. He is the CEO and founder of Light. That's L-Y-T. Light is a cloud-based software platform that uses state-of-the-art connected vehicle and machine learning technologies to prioritize the flow of vehicles in a city and across a corridor. By optimizing public transport, emergency, and other vehicles, they enable shorter travel times, less congestion, improved air quality, and more reliable mass transit. Tim Menard, welcome to Cool Science Radio. Great to have you.
Hi, it's a pleasure to be here as well. Thanks for having me this morning.
Well, Tim, you have for the longest time, even going back to, you know, I think your master's project when you were in college, you've been really working on the interplay between, you know, connected vehicles, I guess we call them, and the exchange of information that might pass on to infrastructure out there. Can you give us a little survey of, you know, where it started and then how you got to where you are now?
Yeah, you know, it's since 2009 I got into this, and I was living in Alaska and was talking with some friends of student government and thought about, hey, wouldn't it be great if we could track snow plows so we could get through all the snow and drive safer? And the iPhone just came out and Google Maps was just appearing, and that's how I got into this. Started off by what can we do with our phones and how do we make our drive safer for everyone?
That's so.
And it just spiraled into tons of stuff.
It's funny that you say that, because here in Utah, they had, and I looked for it last year and did not find it, but they had the Utah Department of Transportation, UDOT, had a snowplow tracker. So if it's a blizzard and you're going to, say, the airport in Salt Lake from Park City, you can choose to go right after when the snowplows pass by. But again, I looked for it this year. You'd think these technologies would be improving, but it wasn't around this year. So who knows? But back to your history, you were at Toyota and then Tesla, and then now you founded Light. Talk about the relationship between what you were doing at Tesla and Light is.
Yeah, and real quick to pick up on your comment there as to how in our public sector, we can have a solution one year and then kind of not the next. And every city right now is going on this path of kind of doing their own one-off. How do you put it all together? And at Tesla, where I was working on helping build the cars and working on their electronics, and then worked on safety systems and then saw some autonomy. That was where the aha moment was, like, the cars have enough information. They know more than what's going on. It's a matter of kind of society and letting it go how do we get this information back? But how do we do this so that every city, every community can participate? And that's the big challenge. And that's what we're seeing right now, like in your example right here in Utah. Everyone's got a little different flavor of the same popsicle.
You are just joining us on Cool Science Radio. We're having a conversation with Tim Menard. He's the CEO and founder of LYT Light. Light's a cloud-based software program. It helps to prioritize the flow of vehicles in a city and across a corridor using machine learning technologies. Tim, I read online that TSP, the acronym Transitional Signal Priority, has been used by a number of communities, but as it relates to emergency vehicles, a lot of TSP systems just turn the light green to allow the emergency vehicle through, and they don't necessarily take into consideration what that will do to the traffic flow. I mean, they may end up stepping on their own foot by having that type of solution. How is your solution different?
Yeah, so the Transitional Priority and Emergency Vehicle Preemption Systems that we have are, if you've ever used a TV remote control, the technology there is an IR sensor to the TV. And we've all have played, does the TV turn on in the living room from different spots? And that's what is currently been used on streets today, is the same kind of tech. So what Light does is go from being a field of view, I see you right in front of me, maybe 1,000 feet away, and transition that to bird's eye view, where the difference is now we know if you left the station, the scene of an incident, and now it's being able to set all of our street systems up to give green lights sooner in advance, in time, with natural transitions, so that we take away that other perspective or experience that we all experience, which is, oh no, the emergency vehicle is now on top of us and we don't know what to do at an intersection.
Yeah, and it's interesting, when I think about your bird's eye view, you don't have to increase the traffic flow 50% over the other TSP system. You could just increase it over like 5 or 10% and have a demonstrable effect on that whole thing, because just a few percentage of buses slowing down and not able to do their routes on a 15-minute cycle, for an example, just something like that could really slow a system down, couldn't it?
Absolutely. This is a type of scenario where every single impact is a cascading. So to even just miss one is now going to put a ripple in the system.
Tim, I'm wondering if, I mean, we all know that there are these physical sensors at the right at the light that are embedded into the pavement, I think. And I'm wondering if that to you also seems, you know, being that you worked at Tesla and what you're doing now, that if that still seems like 1970s technology. And how effective are those? Because I've been at a stoplight, for example, you know, at around midnight and backing up and going forward at on one of those sensors, thinking it's going to turn the light green, but it doesn't.
You know, some communities say that 20% of their infrastructure is actually compromised at any time. And those street sensors are, they take the biggest beating. They're in the street. There's been a lot of movement to replacing those with cameras. So at least they can hopefully detect you now. But really at the end of the day, whether it's a camera, whether it's a sensor in the street, the issue comes down to also how much time did someone put into setting up that traffic light to make its decisions. And unfortunately, a lot of these systems don't get the kind of attention and calibration, which is one of the reasons why Light has gone out to gather all this information from vehicles, ambulances, and transit, is because now with our everyday world changing, getting these little micro adjustments back into a system that maybe has only been calibrated once every 3 to 10 years makes that huge difference, so that we don't have to wait anymore because it was set up on what traffic was like 5 years ago.
Yeah, that's interesting. I wanted to ask you, you know, we're in Utah here, and there is a company that I'm curious whether or not you're familiar with called Blinksy, that was based and founded in Salt Lake City, and it seems to play off Bluetooth, you know, any Bluetooth activation that there is in cars, whether it's your phone or, you know, your Apple Watch or whatever it is, that does sort of the same thing, but they also seem to have used it a lot for data, a data mining tool. For example, during the Sundance Film Festival, that is largely how they were able to get statistics and data on how many people were coming into town and where they were coming from. Is that a familiar company or concept?
The concept's very familiar. And the nice thing about that is that it's trying to get to the root of what people want, which is getting a kind of story of the whole. It's not the point data, and it's not the who are you, what color is your t-shirt, what kind of car are you driving. It's more of, we know we're getting a lot of volume, and it's a solution that allows the city, the community, to be able to pick up on this data without having to go to like a third party where they might have to pay for that data through an API. So when deployed in some places, it can be highly successful.
Right. Okay. I was reading somewhere how Elon Musk this was also a concept at Tesla of Elon Musk saying, you know, we have so much automated here. Why isn't it tying into our infrastructure? And I suppose that you working on Tesla or at Tesla had a large influence on you. Will you talk about that, you know, incredibly creative influence it must be?
Oh, absolutely. That was a phenomenal experience. And really got to push the envelope. And then also prior to that, being at Toyota, where being such an established dominant player as well, and seeing the two different philosophies. But the one thing that they could both really agree on is when you need to have cars that drive in not just one community, but nationwide or internationally, you can only make bets on technology that's going to go globally. And so coming back to, well, why isn't our infrastructure connected, is because there's not enough. It's a huge collaboration project amongst all of our stakeholders, the state, the federal, the locals, and everybody's kind of had their freedom to pick. And now we need kind of a universal solution. And so to see that at Tesla, that again, we have so much information. The vehicles really have the ability to connect. They know your calendar, my calendar, navigation, Google, so much access. And then you look back at our public agencies that are just now coming in to getting technology that you and I are used to as consumers, being able to pull up your phone, pull up your bank account, access any data at will. And that's kind of like the missing link that we decided to go out and challenge, that we could solve and not accept the status quo, so that we can holistically move as a unit together and share lessons learned, because there's a lot of lessons learned from both sides here. And now it's just time to fix the hardest possible part of our whole mobility plan, is collaboration between all of our different modes. And the pandemic challenged that even before the pandemic, with the huge amount of congestion, seeing scooters and micro mobility, and everybody now asking for, hey, we need more options. Just taking our cars isn't working anymore. We're stuck in traffic. It's uncomfortable. And the younger generation, such as myself, only having known roadways to be completely congested, the thrill of driving is not there like it once was in decades prior.
That's for sure. When I was driving up here last week, I was on 495 that was built when I was in high school, and I think there were 11 people on the entire highway when they opened it. And now it is not a good experience. It's just jam-packed. There's no such thing as rush hour. It is on all the time, and it's congested, and it's, you know, it's just interesting. I wanted to get back to something that Lynn first introduced about scrubbing data from people that drive by in their cars. If you have geolocation not enabled on your phone, then no one's going to be able to scrub your data. When we're talking about metadata, is that correct? Just, they don't know who you are. They just know where you are.
Yeah, that's talking about if you're not actually plugged into an app and you specifically authorize share my data, then it's just basic breadcrumb information at that point.
And when you drive down the road of a city where there's some shopping and retail and restaurants and all of that, you might be, a company like yours might be scrubbing the data for traffic purposes. There might be marketing companies that are scrubbing that same data to find out where the cars are going, and they're thinking about where they're going to locate their next Gap store. There's Uber that keeps their eye on all of us. Once you enable the geolocation on Uber once, unless you go back into the app and turn it off, they know where you are. I mean, there's so many people that know where we are. Is this getting out of hand a little bit, or is this something that we need to manage, or do you think we're doing okay?
You know, I think it comes down to the reason why each of us chooses to share our information is because we derive a value out of it. And as long as we derive a value that we're comfortable with, then we're going to continue to share that data. And I think that as we continue to move forward, being very clear and transparent in every industry and any developer or company as to what is that purpose doing and what is the benefit. And so for, you know, maybe in Lyft and Uber's case, that benefit right there is understanding how to better serve and serve you and your habits. It's no different than how maybe some of the other services you use on your app are doing a better job of taking you straight to what really matters. So yeah. I think we're too quick to jump into that we're giving all of our data away with nothing in return, and that we're getting too much privacy up. And in a lot of ways, it's a symbiotic exchange and value. Like Google Maps would not be, or Waze would not be what it is today without this community of people sharing the state of things. And the benefit to that is, well, now we know during rush hour, if there's been a car accident and we should take an alternative route. Mm-hmm. And that's what's super helpful is remembering that we're still a connected whole, and that this is what cell phones have done for us, has been able to share, like, right, I'm called in right now on my cell phone and I can see you over video chat. And now to bring this back into all the other aspects of our life, where it's all these little things that can come back into kind of an orchestrated whole that move us all better. And in a world where we have exploited and have come up against the limits of what we can continue to just build ourselves out of, now really focusing in on what we have and using it more effectively and efficiently is where we're going to see the next big turn in performance and exchange. Yeah. And ultimately time savings, right? That's what we really care about most. Are we going to be able to safely do what we want today?
Tim, it seems that 5 or 6 years ago, everybody was talking about autonomous vehicles, saying that by 2022, they would not only be here, but we'd all be in autonomous vehicles, or we'd be moving towards those sorts of things. And it's turned out to be more difficult than everybody imagined. But the promise of autonomous vehicles, what will that do for traffic mitigation?
Where we'll see it first, and I think about it all the time because I'm always at the traffic light looking at these. One of the biggest performance gains we're going to see, and that was kind of the first original promise of connected vehicles, was actually for intersection management, which right now a typical traffic engineer knows that when a traffic light changes, pretty much each car will need about 3 seconds. That's called their startup loss. And so if you got 10 cars there during a rush hour, then you got 30 seconds until the 10th car is going to clear that road. And this is simple math. So what's going to happen now is with automation and connectivity, as soon as that light changes green and they all can move as a unit, now you can clear all those vehicles in the true time it takes to just accelerate and travel that whole platoon through. So that's why I get really excited about where these advancements are coming from, is because when you look at our day-to-day commutes and recognize that a lot of stop and go makes up about 30 to 40% of that, by no longer trying to game our own self-driving, but getting back to a whole that works together, we could see reductions in our travel time up to 40%. That'd be phenomenal.
It absolutely would. And as you're talking along, first of all, about privacy, I remember 10 years ago or so, John and I were talking about some of the discoveries we made when our cell phone, you know, seemed to be able to track us or seemed to know who we were with and suggest that we might be their friend on Facebook or whatever. We were sort of flabbergasted, and now that seems like, you know, such a bygone era of being surprised by that. But when we talk about privacy and what you said about, you know, all of the information's out there, and it's a symbiotic relationship that we benefit from as well as give away our privacy. It makes me wonder, the first time that I saw that my little smartphone picked up where I live and wherever I am, it'll say, oh, it'll take you about 8 minutes to get home. That I felt a bit of discomfort with that, but I didn't turn off my geolocation. And it makes me wonder about the human, you know, response to this. And it's probably something that you know a lot about, Tim. Could you comment on that?
You know, the great thing about being human is this is how we learn, and we iterate very quickly. And what we've seen from the early days, which was, oh, here's a map, here's everything, where we saw this like too much sharing, and then quickly the bad actors stepped out. And we quickly realized, okay, how do we now start refining and tuning this? And today we see the ability to now put like, where's your work? Where's your home? And keep this on your actual device so that you yourself can see your start to end location. But in some of these communities, like I'm in Strava, I ride my bike. You can actively show people, where have I been today, right? Perfect place to track what I'm doing. But I can set up like areas of privacy from, well, how far do I want to show like where my work is, where my home is, and cut this stuff out so that if I'm doing commutes, then it's much harder for bad actors to kind of work. And I think that's where we keep pushing the limits. And there's a lot of companies and, you know, like the phone I'm using right now, it does a lot of work to make sure that the data stays on your device and just the necessary information needs to pass back and forth so that the anonymity is extremely high. And we look at that the same way too. We want to make sure that we have a kind of picture of the whole in simple ways and not be able to identify, because it also, to me, it doesn't do anything for me to identify.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering who your customers are. I mean, I'm assuming they are like Utah Department of Transportation or cities or counties. How does one implement this cloud-based software?
So the customers that we currently service at the moment are emergency services, transit services, the city. And so they all have a known, their systems already know where those are. They share that information with us securely. And so because we are taking on the ability to prioritize them over some others, we do get identification information with that we keep within that domain. And what that allows us to then do is connect back to traffic lights and give that bird's eye view back and be a virtual sensor that's no longer physically rooted at the ground or at location. So that, one, the only way that anybody, you actually can't spoof a system because we use multiple data streams that then actually come from the actual like fire agency. And because of that, this actually is moving in the direction now of where you can't have bad actors and you can't even misuse the equipment. Where before, this is a fun one. So the original preemption equipment, someone figured out in the Midwest that you could trip the original IR sensor, infrared sensor, and you could get through all the lights whenever you wanted. And that was a big deal for a little bit, and they had to go back through and iterate on that. So even in this technology, people have figured out ways to game the system. And technology continues to iterate very quickly and capture exactly why what's happening, where, and then how do you go back and even make it better the next time through.
Tim, I'm curious about this, and that is that there are cameras everywhere, on every street corner and in between the street corners, and there are moving cameras. Every city bus has a camera in the front, a camera in the back, one on each side. We certainly know how to speed up traffic and to allow the emergency vehicles through. If somebody was to scrub some video and there was a child abduction and they were able to ascertain, based on the description of the car or something, they were able to find this car, can your system, can somebody go in real time and slow down traffic in a certain area to capture that person in traffic?
You know, that is an interesting idea. And one that could be done if a community wanted to do it. That's not a specific feature. We have not implemented abduction mode, but that's a very interesting idea. But it's not far off from being a reality if that's something that wanted to be done.
I mean, talk about a manhunt, like the Boston bomber, for an example, within a 2 mile radius, they wanted to shut down that city and see everybody that went through that 2 mile area by car and by foot. And your system could help out the car side.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It is very possible to impact everybody's day very quickly.
Yeah.
Well, that was
a
great
one of the responsibilities we do take. It is very true.
I'm wondering about John's potential as a consultant to Light. I mean, that was a great idea. You'd not thought of that before, Tim.
Well, you know what? All of us live this every day. Mm-hmm. We're all active. We're all community members. It's what I tell when I speak with everybody about this, is that we don't have to take these systems for granted. A lot of us have just grown up with this the way it is. And just, okay, this is it. We'll just get mad. We'll drive. We know traffic is painful at times. We'll just accept it. And we're just trying to push the mission here that we don't really have to anymore. This is something that has the ability to be corrected. And here are ways we can start doing it on a step-by-step basis so we can go to the most important community needs and bring it back to all of us.
Tim, where can people follow this technology, Light, L-Y-T?
So we're always posting on LinkedIn. We have a LinkedIn page. You can look us up, L-Y-T as well on LinkedIn. Follow us there. We're always posting videos, content, how-tos. Everything goes to our website as well at light.ai.
Excellent. Tim Menard, who's the CEO and founder of Light, is our guest, and we're so pleased that you could join us today on Cool Science Radio. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you, Tim.
It's KPCW Park City. Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio. If you want to share it, all our shows are under the Shows tab. We also podcast all of KPCW's Public Affair Hour shows. Wherever you find your podcasts, you can find them under KPCW and the individual show name. So look for KPCW Cool Science Radio.
If you enjoyed this episode, please rate us, give us a 5, and leave us a comment.
Take us along on your next adventure to the moon.
If you have any story ideas, please let us know at coolscienceradio@kpcw.org.
Thanks for listening, and hey, tune in next week.